Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I'm Marcus. So, what is it with K2-18b? Do we finally have something? Is this the answer to the age-old question of whether we're alone in the universe? It seems James Webb has discovered a potent contender for the big win, a Neptune-sized planet 120 light-years away with an atmosphere containing traces of CO2 and methane, and an additional molecule that can only exist on Earth as a result of biochemical processes. The jury is still out though, but hey, we may have something. But what if we have something? A planet governed by a highly intelligent pink slime having solved the Riemann hypothesis and capable of time travel. We will have to wait until they contact us back and pay us a visit, because with our feeble means of transportation, we will never get there. Let's do some simple math. The fastest human-made object in space is the Parker Solar Probe, with a top speed of, and now brace yourselves, a top speed of 700,000 kilometers per hour. That is insane. That is some 200 kilometers per second for a limited time span, though. Good, now let's set sail for K2-18b. To travel the distance of 120 light-years, a spaceship at the speed of the Parker probe would travel for 170,000 years. Homo sapiens has been around for 200,000. So my question to you is it better to know or not know if there is life out there? Frustration is guaranteed on both ends of the answer. So let's focus on something equally captivating, but maybe less frustrating. I have the great privilege and pleasure to welcome Dr. Space Junk Alice Gorman, space archaeologist, author, and visionary mind for the second time on this show. This time, I'm meeting up with Alice on an Airbnb in my hometown, Vienna, where she's been hiding out, putting down some thoughts for an upcoming book she may be willing to give some super exclusive insights into on this episode. So friends, this one is for all of you, no matter where you come from. This one sweeps the floor with a broad broom, sweeping away anything in its path. Just what you were looking for, right? Let's go. What brings you to Vienna?
Well, I feel I have a strong affinity with Vienna. Normally, I live in Adelaide in South Australia, and people think I'm a bit mad when I say Vienna kind of reminds me of Adelaide, because they're kind of similar small cities, and it's kind of very easy to feel at home very quickly in both of them. So what brings me here this time, though, is to write a book manuscript. I wrote a book a few years ago, and I wrote that manuscript in Vienna as well. So I just felt there was a good vibe here.
What was the last one about?
The last book was called Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future.
That got pretty popular.
It seemed, people seemed to like it and to read it, which of course made me very happy. That was a book basically about why approaching human endeavors in space from an archaeological context had something to offer us. So I was looking at what it is we can learn from space by looking at the material culture, which is what archaeologists do. And I used a lot of my favorite examples of space things and places, which include like the oldest satellite in Earth orbit, Vanguard 1, up there since 1958, a wonderful little amateur Australian satellite, Australis Oscar 5, launched in 1970. So both of these are space junk. One represents the kind of beginning of the space age. The other one shows that you don't have to be a wealthy nation with a space agency or a wealthy company to put something in space. You can be, as Australis Oscar 5 was, created and launched by a group of university students. So a lot of these stories centered around objects was what I was looking at in this book.
By the way, have you heard 2 days ago a very sad news that NASA lost connection to Voyager 2?
No, I didn't hear this.
Yeah, so...
And they haven't reestablished it?
I haven't checked up on that, but I just read the headline and I'm hoping not for the worst.
Oh, I hope you're right. Voyager 2 is my favorite.
This is such an archaeological artifact already, isn't it?
It is. It's completely archaeological. The spacecraft itself, were it to be found by future humans or future non-humans, is a snapshot of the technology of the time, of what it took in 1977 to get outside the solar system. The thing that everybody loves about the Voyagers, though, is the golden records. Yeah. 90 minutes of music
Chuck
from
Berry,
Earth.
Mozart.
And some Australian Aboriginal music.
Yes.
1.29 seconds of that. And some Akkadian music, some of the oldest Chinese music ever known. It also had, I think, 166 photographs on it. It had people speaking greetings in different languages of Earth. It had a lot of official messages, politicians and important people talking to those future aliens or future humans. There's even an Australian voice on there. So the Australian cultural attaché to the United Nations spoke a little message there, but in Esperanto.
The Australian guy?
Yeah. So it's not even in English. He was an Esperanto nut. So, and for listeners who aren't aware of this, this was a made-up language that started in the, I don't know, it could have even been the 19th century, I'm not sure. Yeah. But the idea was to make a common language for all the people of Earth. I have no idea if people still learn it or if it's still a thing. But his voice is speaking in Esperanto on the Voyager Golden Records. But they're like that just there's three tracking stations on Earth that receive signals from Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And they're running out of power, of course.
Yes.
They've shut down, I think, almost all of their instruments.
Yeah.
And we know at some point we're going to lose contact with them. But I wanted it to be later rather than sooner, obviously.
Absolutely.
And to me, they're like, it's not like I think about Voyager 2 every day, but just knowing that they're out there, knowing that they're kind of part of our sensorium in some way.
This gives me the chills still right now. Just thinking right now, as we speak, in this very moment, this piece of human technology is out there, as lonely as something can be. Just imagine where this thing is in the vastness of outer space right now. There's this golden record with all those pieces of art and whatnot on it. This is mind-blowingly crazy because it goes beyond my understanding what that means.
I think you're right. Yeah. It is something that just gives you goosebumps. It's so far away.
It's not just a machine anymore. This is something almost, I don't know what it is. You have a better understanding why sometimes we feel attached to dead matter. I feel attached to it like as if it were a being. Whatever that is, maybe because of narratives around it. Maybe there's stories and blah, blah, blah. But I feel for and with that piece of machinery. How about you?
I'm absolutely on your page with that one. I do too. There's a school of thought which says we shouldn't anthropomorphize things. We shouldn't imbue them with feelings and emotions. We should, you know, they're technology, they're not alive, they can't respond, they can't engage with us. And, you know, we're just being a bit foolish by allowing ourselves to have all of these emotions. But to those people, I say, about to say something rude in an Australian fashion, I say, get stuffed. I mean, isn't it an incredible thing that we can allow ourselves to feel so deeply for a machine like that? I mean, isn't that something we should be acknowledging and even celebrating, that our capacity, okay, our capacity for love reaches beyond the human into the robotic? And isn't that a good thing? I would have thought.
I think it's a good thing if we try to understand what love is, what emotion is, because if we're capable of loving a TV set or a glass
or
of water.
Or a smartphone. Many people have a deep passion for their...
But there's something to it that speaks about our being human beings, what that means. So I think it's an important message we're sending by that capability. So we shouldn't push it off the table.
We should not. And I think this raises for me another interesting question, which is our emotional attachment to celestial bodies. So I think you could say, well, maybe you can't say. I mean, most people alive on Earth would feel an attachment to the Earth, the planet Earth, which we rely on for our existence. But people seem to have a capacity to separate emotional feelings about the moon. Let me ask you, what is the moon to you? You know I'm obsessed with the moon, so we're probably always going to moon. But how do you feel about the moon? How does that make you feel?
The moon is a gray, barren, dry, and dead place to me. It used to be part of Earth, but still it's out there and it doesn't feel alive. So I'm just spilling out my ideas and my immediate reactions. So the moon may be a place, a future home to humans, because it's part of who we are. But it's dead and gray and dry and full of human trash.
That's very interesting. I think there are a lot of people who feel similarly. I don't. So I want to represent a different kind of image of the moon. I think one of the reasons it's easy to think of the moon in that way is because we kind of have this automatic reaction to grayscale colors. Mm-hmm. We're so used to color, being surrounded by color of different kinds. I mean, to the extent that, you know, as an Australian, when I come to Europe, I often find it poorer in color than Australia.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I have to sort of adjust my senses here because I find it less colorful.
So it's more flat.
Yeah, I guess so. And I think if, particularly as you say, like people are going to go back and live on the moon, I think we don't have the right language to describe and understand the moon yet. And some of the astronauts started to develop that, particularly I would say Alan Bean, who was on the Apollo 12 mission in the end of 1969. So he was an artist. He used to paint, and he did this before he went to the moon. And when he came back, he painted lots of pictures of the moon. You can see them online if you go and look up his website. I think he's passed on, but his art is still available. And he didn't see it as grey. He saw lots of a different palette of colors, like mauves and yellows and sort of very muted shades, different shades of purple and yellow, really. And I think if people are going to go and live there, maybe it's their job to develop a new vocabulary to understand the way light and shadow work on the moon. And, you know, there's an old, I think this may or may not be true, I can't remember, but that people who live in the Arctic Circle, like Inuit people, have 56 words for different kinds of snow.
Exactly.
And I know there's a rich vocabulary of snow, even if that's not strictly true. And it's about things like color and texture and context and all that kind of stuff. So we kind of don't have anything like that for the moon yet, particularly close up. And I also think, so human eyes are good in the light and bad at night.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of animals who have well-developed night vision.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, oh, you know, dogs see in black and white, poor dogs. Well, but animals who have, and I can't remember which one it is, it's rods or cones. So if you have more cones in your eyes, you will see more color. Mm-hmm. And if you have more rods, you will be able to see in the night. So what if our eyes are the wrong eyes for the moon?
Mm.
What if we sent animals with different kinds of vision up there? I mean, the problem is we can't ask them.
Mm.
But we could probably simulate it in some way. Maybe they will actually understand the lunar landscape better than we can, because the structure of their eyes allows them to see far more than just sort of different shades of black and white and grey.
Before sending my cats or my... my kids got a bunch of animals. Anyways, before sending my cats to the moon, I think we should send artists and poets for a different viewpoint.
I think that's a brilliant suggestion.
Yeah.
That's part of what that Japanese space entrepreneur is doing, isn't it? Sending some artists to the moon.
Elon also announced it. To bring, I think, Starship with, I don't know, 15 artists mm-hmm. from different walks of life in an orbit around moon. That was 2 years ago or so. So maybe that mission is still alive, but Japanese or Elon, someone has to do it to paint that different picture that we may need. Because so far we've only had astronauts with an engineering understanding and a scientific understanding or vision of the world, of the moon. But what if you bring yourself as a writer, bring Mitch Goldberg, whom we had on the show, as a poet? That would be really interesting. But I'm hoping it will happen.
I think it would be really interesting. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you put an artist in a different context and they're going to see connections that the likes of you and me don't see. They're going to come up with those new terms and languages.
Because I mean, like, sorry for interrupting, but I mean, like, if a science engineering person can be moved by the Earthrise as the astronauts were moved, just imagine the sheer potential if you approach people with maybe more artistic or more, I don't know, different antennas. Because the astronauts, they came all transformed back from the moon and back from those experiences.
You're right, too. In 1968, wasn't it? The Earthrise photo.
Yeah.
Like the minute they saw that, because it wasn't a scheduled photograph. They didn't have the cameras ready to hand. The minute they saw it, they knew, didn't they? They knew this was something extraordinary.
Because it was for the first time, it was that view from their home planet that no human has seen before. And that must have been groundbreaking. This is why it's still an iconic image.
And you know, I think... I'm not a fan of Mars. Apologies to the Martian nuts out there. I'm on Team Venus, which we were talking about earlier. But I know, like, talking to people who just long to go to Mars, that's part of what they often mention, that experience of seeing. And, of course, it's much further away from Mars, but that experience, the fact that you have to be there, like a photograph, a simulation isn't good enough. They want to be there themselves to watch the Earth rise above the Martian horizon. And I can kind of get that. Like, I don't want to be the person doing that. But I think that's something, you know, easily people still go every day. We have a sunrise and a sunset. And those are still special experiences for people, aren't they? We're still at the corner of our eyes, you know, walking down the street at dusk watching the sunset and thinking, yes. Oh, that's a good one, yeah. Even though it happens every day and has for 4.5 billion years.
Yes. Mm. I'm moved by the concept behind it because I keep reminding myself what's going on up there on the sun, how far away it is, that the sunset is 8 minutes old. And maybe the sun doesn't exist anymore. And I will only learn about it in 8 minutes.
Marcus, this is a dark turn of conversation.
No. But like the concept of the sun, what's happening on that star, where the gas, the helium and the hydrogen come from, and that all dates to the Big Bang, and that the sun is in fact the factory we're all made of, producing all the matter that exists. And now we got a sunset or a sunrise reminding us of all that. That's what moves me very much when I'm looking at the sun.
So you feel very connected to the sun in that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know, I think this is why the Parker Solar Probe is a bit of a special spacecraft as well. Just the thought that it's going to get so close, so much closer than we could ever get in and send us back pictures. It's already sent back some great pictures, yes. But it hasn't got to its closest approach yet, I don't think. That's coming in a couple of years, yes. Or something. So, yeah, by proxy, we're going to get close to, you know, as you say, this incredible furnace that,
yes,
has such an impact on
the cradle, lives. The cradle of everything. It's the cradle of life, mm-hmm. on Earth, because without the sun, no you and me. But it's also the cradle of the Earth, the cradle of matter, the cradle of everything. This is something I truly love pondering about because it's so immense. It's so vast. It's so ungraspable. Yeah.
I wonder if people listening to you now will, you know, go outside their doors and look at the sun with new eyes as well.
I hope so. And then just imagine the sun being one teeny weeny speck of light in the myriad of suns out there. Anyways, I'm drifting off.
lost in the contemplation of the cosmos.
So we started when I asked you about you being here in Vienna. You said you're writing a book. Is it official to talk about it, or is it still a secret?
I think I can talk about it.
Okay.
If you'd asked me a month ago before I arrived, I'd probably have had some not very coherent things to say about it. And maybe they're still incoherent. I'm not sure. But basically, I kind of want to take our ideas about what we're doing in space apart and put them back together again. So, and you know, I'm an archaeologist, so mm-hmm. I probably have some particular perspectives that relate from studying human behavior and the origins of human behavior for most of my professional career. So, I suppose the basic premise of the book is, we're in this extraordinary time at the moment where we have all these private corporations who are starting to dominate decisions that are made about what gets launched, where people go, what kinds of projects get off the ground. We have, I think the figures are something like 40% of all satellites have been launched in the last few years. So, you know, we were puttering along thinking Kessler syndrome, you know, it's off there in the future, you know, incremental steady build up. Well, it has been a little bit of an exponential build up, but
15 years, you know, we got, they say. Is that true, that if the Kessler syndrome is a thing, that we got 15 years to fix the space junk problem?
Look, you'll get a different opinion on that from every person that you talk to. But I think what's happening now is pretty alarming. So predictions of like 100,000 more satellites in low Earth orbit by the end of the decade
100,000.
Some predictions of that, because there's now, you know, 3 or 4 mega constellation companies, and you know, the argument is, yeah, they're all going to re-enter and it's not going to be that bad. But 40% of satellites launched in the last few years. I mean, that's quite horrifying. And as yet, we have no proven technology to remove the old debris from orbit.
No jurisdiction against new constellations, or I think a structurized constellation making. So I think anyone can put up their constellation at the moment, and that's the problem.
Yeah. So we're kind of duplicating a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
And we've also kind of become seduced by the idea that this stuff has to be delivered from space. It doesn't. The risk is the more reliance we put on space-based assets, the less terrestrial infrastructure that does the same things will be maintained until we won't have the choice anymore. Mm-hmm. Cables, for example. So, you know, it's expensive to maintain cables, to put new cables in. But if we let them go because we say it's fine, it's all in space now, then that's a very much all our eggs in one basket situation. And it's not even, you know, space debris that's going to be the problem here. It could be solar flares and all kinds of things. So we're kind of getting to a bit of a tipping edge situation, a lot faster than people originally predicted. So, and you know, people talk endlessly, sustainability, everybody's all about sustainability. Well, I'm over sustainability. Mm. It's empty words. Mm. There's nothing where, that's unfair actually. I think there's some really positive dialogues in the space community at the moment about, you know, making the most efficient use of resources, of including more countries, more people in the world, benefit sharing, all that stuff. I think there's some really positive conversations happening around that, but none of that has actually happened yet.
But I'm with you. I don't like sustainability anymore. It's getting on my nerves, in fact, because it's such an empty term. And to be super honest, I understand sustainability completely different. Sustainability, when we talk about it as a society, is very much focused on ecological sustainability. But to me, it's a lot more. Sustainability is everything that allows for a meaningful tomorrow. Everything, all the decisions we made, if they are made sustainably, they're made consciously. And sustainably and consciously means, how am I treating my employees? How am I treating my own body? How am I treating my children? If I have answers in place that go together with sustainability, as I understand it, I think we are a lot closer to having a solution in place for all our problems. Because if we're making decisions consciously and not out of consumerism or whatnot, then I think everything or many things will be fine and good again. And this is the most tricky part, I think. So I understand sustainability a lot broader, and maybe that needs a new term.
Maybe it does. I think that's a really interesting perspective. I think there's, at the other end from what you're describing, there's what you hear often in the space community, which is sustainability is nothing more than making sure that we don't use up all the moon's mineral resources in the next 10 years and we leave some for future generations. And that to me seems, it's a pretty low bar.
Yeah, it is.
What you're talking about, I think, is something that sort of goes all the way up and all the way down, like across all levels of an organization, a whole ethos of action in the world that I think comes closer to something that I think would work better.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great definition. It's not just about the natural world. It's about human behavior within that. So I think that's a much better, maybe we do need a new word, because sustainability has been so overused at the moment. So this is something that I'm definitely discussing in the context of this book. The other things I'm interested in is the idea, I've been looking at the treaties again, and I used to say, people would say, oh, well, you know, the Outer Space Treaty, it's outdated, it was made all the way back in 1967, it's no good anymore, particularly because it doesn't have the capacity to deal with commercial exploitation. And I've always been saying, no, the Outer Space Treaty is absolutely fine. Those provisions about non-appropriation of territory, peaceful uses, benefit sharing for all humanity, that stuff is so important and we need to keep that. But as I've kind of been working through ideas for the writing I'm doing right now, I'm actually coming to change my mind, which is not a position I thought I would come to, but if you look at the treaty language, it's all about the use of space and the use of celestial bodies. It makes an assumption that space is our right to use. Mm. It's our birthright by virtue of being born human. And this relates, I think, to a couple of very old ideas. One of them is the great chain of being, which has its origins in the thinking of Aristotle back in the 5th century before the Common Era, is very developed in the sort of medieval world, which you manage to have like monarchs at the top of the great chain of being. And of course, God is always at the very pinnacle and at the very bottom of the great chain of being. You have inanimate things like rocks and minerals. So this kind of idea that we're at the top and all those minerals at the bottom, we have a right to by virtue of a hierarchy. I mean, that's a medieval idea and we're using it in space. That's kind of part of what the treaties are saying. And then you have the idea of, well, it's mankind in the treaties, but, you know, we'll read that as sort of humankind, humanity. So we have this idea and we're putting humans in this central place again. We're putting humans on Earth. So this is a pre-Copernican idea. So I think Copernicus came up or proved by astronomical observations that the Earth was not the center of the universe in 1543 or something, but we're still acting as if it is and as if humans as inhabitants of that Earth were the center of the cosmos. And so we end up with these treaties which are essentially saying, you know, it's like the Garden of Eden, God saying to Adam, not to Eve, saying to Adam, go out. This is all for you. All of these things I've made just for you. This is how the space community thinks. And of course, if you asked anyone, they would never express it just like that. But these are really old ideas and we're still using them going out into space. So surely we need to have a
reconsider
more, yes, at the very least, I think.
So why is no one talking about this? You're now talking about it. Why is that? Why is that? Is there anything we can learn from indigenous communities in that respect?
I think there is. And of course, I can only speak secondhand on this, not being indigenous, but I have spent my pre-space professional career was working with Aboriginal communities in Australia on heritage management. So Indigenous cosmologies and philosophies tend to be flat and tend to be a web of obligations and responsibilities. So very different in that regard. So you would in a sort of classic, I mean, there's a lot of variation, but like in general in Australia, a more or less common underlying theme is that a person will have responsibilities towards different animals, plants, environments, stars in some cases are part of this as well. So it's reciprocal. It's not based around, you know, nobody talks of use as such, although obviously people depend on natural resources to sustain themselves in the same way everyone does. So it's a completely different philosophy. And it would be really interesting. I mean, there's a couple of traditional owners in Australia who are sort of thinking about these things at the moment, doing some really interesting work. So, like we used to, you know, you alluded to this before, we're now used to ecological thinking, where we think of the interconnectedness of things and that the importance of relationships between things in sustaining those things. So that's kind of a concept that's out there and that people would be fairly comfortable and understand. So, but what some indigenous philosophies say is that it's not just that these different relationships exist, it's that they need to be maintained and someone has to be responsible for them. And that leads to different actions, I think, to a whole different set of actions about how you interact with the sort of material world around you. So I think, yeah, I think there is. The other thing I think is really interesting, so we're approaching space from a capitalist perspective. So the West won the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And that's just become absolutely accepted. But capitalism, as we experience it, I mean, capitalism isn't monolithic either. There are many different versions, and I think we're in sort of a late industrial capitalist phase. There are plenty of people who know more about this than me. But this is just one set of, what do you call it, like political and social structures that have arisen since, I suppose, about since the 14th, 15th century. But humans have existed, humans and human ancestors, for about 3 million years. So the politics and, there's another word I want, but like economic position that we're going out to space is just one of
a myriad
things. So why this one right now? Okay, so it is here and is now. We're living in it. But is it the best suited for space? We're only using it because historically that's where we happen to be right now. But out of the 3 million years of human existence, maybe there are better social and political and economic systems to deal with space. We've got a sample of like this very small little set of ways of acting in the world that belongs to some of the contemporary world. It's not even the whole world who has this system. It's only parts of the world, but that's the one that we're using to structure everything we do in space. So it's just random, you know? Maybe we need to put some more thought into that as well. Exactly as you're, you know, alluding to other systems, like many indigenous worldviews. There's heaps of other stuff out there.
I don't know where that feeling comes from or that observation comes from, but I keep getting the impression that traditional knowledge is becoming more of interest to westernized people. I don't know where that comes from, but I feel like it can become sexy again, so to say, to rediscover our roots. Maybe there will be a day, I could totally imagine something like this, that the Americans will start to rediscover their native roots, their indigenous roots. It took them quite a while to silence them and to put them off into reservations and wherever. But I feel like there is a potential with a burnt out capitalism to refocus on something new. And maybe that something new is that old tradition that has been around for millennia. Maybe it's a naive approach towards things, but this, there is something deep within us that we removed from our history in a very short moment in time. But there is a potential that this thing can come back again and bring us to new levels as a society. Because I think we have reached an endpoint in history. We cannot go on like this. We have no understanding how to, what the alternatives are. So what is it, where are we evolving into? So I think it's a good moment for maybe a renaissance of indigenous culture that was a long and winded road now. But does it make sense to you?
You know, I think you're right. So the first thing I'm thinking in terms of what you're saying is that that dispossession and those processes which removed power from Indigenous people are not very long ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's scary to think, like, when I was young, things that happened 50 years ago, 100 years ago seemed like a long time ago. But you think about this, for this is like people's parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. It's not very long ago. And something we know from the survival of Indigenous cultures around the world is how resilient they were. And that's something, that's a quality that certainly is needed in the way the world's going at the moment. But I think, you know, there's been the big intellectual movement of decolonization, which has that practical aspect of like reparation and reconciliation and maybe return of land to people, but also the more intellectual side of that, which is acknowledging that knowledge doesn't only have the form that emerged from the post-Enlightenment period in Europe, acknowledging that things that were once derided as primitive in inverted commas or scare quotes, you know, in fact were not, were in fact very sophisticated. In Australia, a documentary series has just been released called The First Inventors that looks at Indigenous science, which I don't know if it will be available more widely, but would be worth. So you, mm-hmm. with that kind of thing, you're doing something. You're saying, you're taking traditional knowledge and saying, well, it has been historically judged poorly by the criteria of what we think science mm-hmm. is. What if we turn those criteria on their head to see exactly what was, you know, the knowledge that went into survival with these different technologies and different philosophies, and said, well, this is science too. What do we learn from that? And the other part of that is not just saying, well, let's just now extend the definition of science to these things, but looking at the social embeddedness of those ideas of science, because mm-hmm. we have this sort of terrible, terrible tradition of saying like technology is neutral and science is. In fact, mm-hmm. I haven't seen the film Oppenheimer yet, but mm-hmm. I suspect these are themes that would be in that mm-hmm. film as well. So I think people are thinking about this and talking about it more. I think there's a much greater recognition that, you know, we can't let these ways of being, these knowledges vanish as mm-hmm. they have been. We need to put effort into making sure that they survive. And these ways of understanding the world may be far more beneficial for living in space than the current, as you said, like capitalism is exhausted. It's where we got to where we are right now in the world. I mean, people can say climate change isn't happening. Well, actually, they can't. It is happening. They can dispute the cause, but it's happening. Whatever you think the cause is, and that requires political, social, cultural responses. And if we're about to sort of, you know, jet off into space and live on other planets, we can't be bringing it's just, this baggage with us.
I mean, like, it's just running away. It's, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
We should do our homework first here on Earth and then venture out to different places. Because as you said, bringing that baggage with us, we would destroy Mars as we're destroying Earth. We would destroy the moon as we're destroying Earth. So what difference does it make? So I think we should try a fresh start. And so the deeper we talk about this, I get the feeling that we are still a very primitive society, very primitive, because we're not able to do our homeworks. We're able to build rockets. We're able to build constellations. But are we able to build human beings out of ourselves? Where are we working on our future as human beings? Where is that exactly?
So the way you're talking about it, we have an unfinished project to become human that we're failing at all the time because the high ideals of human behavior that we think are the hallmark of a sophisticated sentient species, we haven't actually arrived at yet.
No, I don't know. Have we even started considering what it means to be human? There have been a bunch of attempts in human history to do so, mostly secluded in the Western world, in centers of knowledge, such being religious places, academic places. I am lacking the understanding of indigenous history, but I guess the same holds true for indigenous places. But on a large scale, where is it that we are pondering about the future of humanity? Where is philosophy at the moment? Philosophy has been a defining element of human history for such a long time. Where is it right now? Where is it right now? Because we need philosophers amidst ourselves in every walks of life right now, more than ever.
Well, you know, part of the answer to that is universities cutting philosophy departments across the world. So one answer to where the philosophers are is that they've lost their jobs. But I think you make a really good point here, because there is that kind of perception out there that philosophers are cut off from the real world and sitting mulling over questions that don't affect our daily lives. And of course, this isn't the case at all. We've got many marvelous philosophers engaging with all of these big questions. But why are they not more? Why is there not greater engagement with this in the rest of the world? Why is that? It's interesting because we are merely a block away from the famous Wittgenstein house.
Yes, here in Vienna.
Which I have walked past a few times. It's now the Bulgarian embassy or something like that. So you can't go in and see the doorknobs. Mm-hmm. Everyone's obsessed with Wittgenstein's.
Doorknobs? Why is that?
I don't know. He took 2 years to design them or something. Like, he held the building of the house up because he wasn't happy with the doorknobs. Mm. So there is a philosopher that's engaged with the real world slowly, but he got there. Mm-hmm. So I want to see those doorknobs. So I think that's a really good question. We need more philosophers. We need more of them in our space community. I know there are a few around who are very interested in these big questions, because it comes back to some big existential questions, doesn't it, at the end of the day?
But I think at the moment we're experiencing, if we survive it, we're experiencing a brilliant moment to force us into thinking about ourselves, and that is the arrival of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Because now, if artificial intelligence is doing almost anything that humans can do, the question is, what is it that humans, only humans, can do? So we're thrown back on that very philosophical question, but without needing philosophy, because we are forced to reconsider our very own identity right now. If we don't do it, we don't have a future, a literal future. Because if we want to become slaves, secondhand artificial intelligences to the machines, there's no future, no need. So what is it that only we can do? And I think if we survive that problem, it's a brilliant moment of evolution for humans.
I want to come back in thinking about this to something you mentioned much earlier in our conversation, because I think what it is that only humans can do is love. And I think that's something we have to hold on to and nurture. You're looking like you don't agree with me.
No, absolutely. I was just thinking what it is about love that only humans can perceive, and what that thing is. We don't even know what it is as humans. There's so many interpretations, but there's no real, that is what love is. So maybe that's why it's difficult to replicate it in machines.
Maybe.
Because we have no understanding, like gravity. We don't know what gravity is. This is why we cannot produce artificial gravity. So we don't know what love is. This is why we cannot.
We can't produce artificial love. No. That's funny you mentioned gravity, because I think, you know, as a school kid, you learn all the equations. You learn about mass, force, da-da-da. Yeah. And then as an adult, when I'm thinking a lot more about gravity, I'm like, but what? How does it work? Like, what is mass? I don't know what mass is. So
the closer you look, everything falls apart.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's true that all this AI stuff, I don't believe that there's going to be an evil AI that will suddenly emerge from the interstices of the internet and
like the Skynet,
make us all slaves, like the Skynet. But I don't fully understand what's going on at the moment. I would venture to say there's lots of people who are, we're all kind of engaging with it at different levels every day, but how can we comprehend where it's going? Like, what decisions do we make based on this? I've got no idea. It's a bit sort of brain curling to think about. But then we come to the, going back to basics. Alan Turing would have, defined if a thing behaves as if it's making decisions and sentient, then it effectively is. Like, what is the difference if the behavior is identical? Are we going to have to, and I think people are already suggesting this, that we need to admit AI entities into the ranks of humanity. And I think now, I'm not sure if this, I think legally this might have happened in a few places, that some primates are now considered human
entities,
legally human.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of boundaries.
But this goes together also with the capacity to experience suffering, maybe, with the primates. So the question is an artificial intelligence able to suffer? Because then one could say, okay, you're an entity.
Yes, that's a good point. How would you cause pain to an artificial intelligence? Turning it off.
Then,
but they wouldn't even know. They wouldn't even know. You're right. That's the other side of that coin, isn't it?
Yeah.
If they can't feel love, which we presume, they could act as if. In fact, this makes me think of one of Isaac Asimov's most famous stories about, which involves the three laws of robotics. Mm-hmm. So a character in this story, I forget its name, is given a robot, and because the three laws, one is that you can't harm a human directly or indirectly, mm-hmm. one is that you have to, I can't remember them, one is that you have to like do nice things for humans. And so it's a weird old sexist kind of story in a way. Anyway, so this woman gets this anthropomorphic, an android, I suppose, mm-hmm. and it sees that she's lonely, so it starts to court her and to be nice to her and bring her flowers, mm-hmm. and make dinners and pour wine, mm-hmm. and she falls in love with it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, it's explained to her that it was merely behaving according to a system of routines that meant it mm-hmm. had to respond to her what she needed, and that was what she needed. So, but how is that different to her experience? Mm. Is not changed. Well, it was changed once they said to her, this robot doesn't love you, mm-hmm. which was rather mean, I think. Her experience of that was no different to the real thing. Mm-hmm. But that there's no suffering in that story. Mm-hmm. But then another set of Asimov stories about the Syrians mm-hmm. who have robots. They're a human. They come from Sirius, but they're mm-hmm. human. I can't remember how that comes about. And they have the crime of roboticide. Mm-hmm. So they consider robots to be equivalent to people. And Lucky Star and his sidekick, whose name I forget now, kill a robot because uh-huh. they see the robots as robots. And the Syrians convict them of roboticide because uh-huh. they've killed her. So, yeah, Asimov had some stuff going on there.
Absolutely. Wow. We keep diverging from the original story, your book. do you have a title for it already?
I've got
a working title.
A working title.
You'll never get rid of.
No way committed to is Don't Laugh, Space, A Manifesto for Redemption.
Huh.
Okay, you're not laughing. That's no. promising.
No, I'm not laughing.
So, I don't know. It's a working title. I may or may not mm-hmm. end up using it. But it's meant to indicate that I'm trying to
reconcile humans with their own planet and space.
Yeah, I guess so. As I'm saying, well, these are the things that are on the table right now. We know they're not going to serve us well when we go into space. Mm. So what do we need? What are the underpinnings of the way we think now? And if we get rid of them and think differently, where do we end up? So it's kind of about trying, because it's all well and good, isn't it, to say, well, we know capitalism is bad for planetary environments. We know we're going to ruin Earth orbit if we keep on going like this. So we can say all those things, and I'm sure most people would, you know, agree with that, but you have to offer something in its place. So I'm trying to get to that place wow. where I can say something concrete that provides a good basis for action we can justify mm-hmm. in the future. I guess that's kind of what it's about. It's not going to be, so it's not, obviously, there's ethical components to that, but I'm not an ethicist. It's not my area of research. Mm-hmm. So it's not a book about ethics. It's sort of an exploration of different ideas and where they might lead us, so that you can say, all right, so our choices are wider than we thought mm-hmm. they were, and let's not assume that there are no choices to make. let's think a bit more deeply about that. So that sounds a bit trite when I describe it like that, but that's what I want to do. I want to give a view of some possible solutions that might maybe work if people wanted to change how they thought about things. Mm.
So who is it for?
It's for the general public. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's for us, like spacey people too. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be aimed just at a general audience. I suppose it's kind of science communication, but I'm trying to make some new arguments in it that I hope have not been made before and that might be useful in some way.
Is there a takeout you may want to preview or share with us right now, an idea you're most proud of?
Yes. So something I'm going to discuss in this book is the Index of Solar System Sustainability. Hmm. I know we were just saying that we're over sustainability. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea that you can take any solar system anywhere in the galaxy, in the cosmos, have a look at what's happened to it through the actions of a sentient technological species, let's say, and assign it a number between 1 and 10. I've got to work out the maths in fine detail, between 1 and 10, or it might be between 0 and 1. And let's say if you score a 1, you have a solar system with a technological sentient, at least one technological sentient species in it, who have not ruined anything. Hmm. If you have 0, you have a solar system which has been completely wrecked. So the terms in this index include the length of time that solar system has existed. So in our case, it's like 4.6 billion years. The number of planets in that solar system, and they don't have to be habitable. Mm-hmm. They just have to be there. The degree to which the number of them which have been ruined, this is a tricky part. How do we define that? One way I'm going to define that is sort of irreversible damage. So, for example, a nuclear holocaust might render a planet uninhabitable by any future life for millions of years. So that kind of thing. So it gives us a method. You assign the index. So it doesn't matter that we haven't as yet found any solar systems we can make this comparison on, but we can do it for ours. So we have 9 planets, including Pluto. I don't care. Pluto is there. We have 1 planet that we are maybe on the verge of ruining. So we calculate the index. We're doing okay because there are eight planets that are still all right, given the length of opportunity. So the reason you put the length of time the solar system has existed there is the opportunity you have to do bad things to planets. There's a hypothetical situation. There's a hypothetical large-scale solar system engineering project called the Dyson Sphere. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things people look for. They say if we find a Dyson Sphere, we know there's intelligent life somewhere else in the universe. So the idea is that a Dyson Sphere is a cloud or swarm of satellites. Sometimes it's a solid shell that catches all the light of the sun. Mm. So it's 100% efficient use.
A shell around the sun.
Yeah, it's a shell around the sun, so which would then emit a certain kind of radiation, which technically you could detect. So the Dyson Sphere requires all of the material in the solar system to construct it. So a solar system in a Dyson Sphere, I mean, there could still be people living in the Dyson Sphere, they're just very efficient. So a Dyson Sphere, a solar system that has been turned into a Dyson Sphere has a 1 or a 10, because it has ruined all the planets. We are maybe, let's say, we're a 1, because we've only nearly ruined one planet. So it's kind of, it's a way of saying, assessing where we are at this point in time. So we're not doing too badly, but it could get worse. So this is the idea that I'm going to mathematically perfect by the time I publish the book. That is a way to think through these things, because I will have to define what it means to be ruined more precisely. That's going to be an interesting one. So it might throw up things that I don't expect, or maybe don't even agree with, but that's how it will work. So the index of solar system sustainability is three S's.
Wow. I like that approach on multiple levels. First of all, it gives us, as we're entering a new understanding of humanity in the wake of becoming potentially interplanetary, we need a new understanding of our planet and of our own identity. So you, with that concept, you are leaving Earth behind and you're zooming out, so to say, you're taking a closer, a wider look at who we are. And this, I think this is, so far, all the philosophies and all the literature has been discussing the planet in the confines of the planet. But I think you are now extending the confines of the planet into the confines of a solar system or a galaxy. And so you're sort of opening the doors for humanity with that idea to venturing out into new territory. I know territory is not a good term, but into new fields of existence as humans. By the way, Barbara Belvisi from Interstellar Labs, she had a very interesting notion in an early episode when I asked her what she thinks our role as humans is in the grand scheme of things. And she says the deeper she thinks about it, the more she feels like it's our role and our role task. I wouldn't say task, but it's our role to help biodiversity spread out from Earth. So we're undergoing an evolution as human beings that at some point makes us able to produce technology that will help biodiversity go to different places, because for whatever reason it started on Earth. And that's an interesting thing to think through. So we are sort of the vessel for a grander story. And so if we are that vessel, and that grander story, I wouldn't say it's a grand design, but maybe biodiversity and life wants to go places and go to different places. Not wants, it's a different concept. Goes to different places. Then we need new maps and new maps in our minds also to understand what we're talking about. So thank you for that sneak peek into your upcoming book.
That is a very sneak peek. Hardly anybody knows about this idea yet.
So I appreciate
I'm sharing
that
it with you now.
Thank you so much. When is the book ready for publishing?
It's going to be a while. So it's still in the writing stage.
Yeah.
And when that's finished, it could still be, another, I don't know, 6 months to a year to sort of go through editing, production, all of that. So not anytime soon, I fear. And I do have to finish writing it, which would be helpful.
Yeah.
But your positive reactions to these ideas is very motivating for me.
Wonderful.
So thank you for that.
How long are you staying in Vienna still? As an inspiration, I guess. You chose
I have
Vienna.
To leave tomorrow.
Tomorrow, after a month?
Yes.
Okay. So what does that mean to the book?
What it means is I have to keep the momentum going. Mm. I can't lose focus once I get back. I think I'm too deep in some of the ideas now. I think it'll be okay. But yeah, without having had this little sort of idyllic break in Vienna, I don't think I would have been able to develop some of them as much as I have been. So this has just been, yeah, very essential to the progress of the whole thing. So
before I hit the record button today, you talked about an awkward encounter at a cemetery here in Vienna. What was that about?
So today.
Today that was.
That was today. Mm-hmm. Which was the awkward bit?
It's in fact not awkward. So it's an interesting find, I should say.
Well, today I went with the Viennese artist Rollo Maier to the Central Cemetery in Vienna, where we visited the grave of Friedrich Schechter, who invented the space pen. One of two people who were responsible for the development of the space pen, which can write in microgravity, and which the US space program used extensively. And he has this wonderful, you wouldn't know if you didn't know that it was meant to be the space pen. I don't think you'd recognize it from looking at it, but it's like a pen with a ballpoint sort of peeled open to show the sort of ink cartridge inside.
You have it on your smartphone. No, you had it on your smartphone. Here it is.
Yeah.
Do you mind showing it to me again?
Yeah. So it looks like...
And maybe I can try to decipher the writings on his gravestone.
So there's the writing.
Okay, Friedrich Schechter, Ehrenbürger der Technischen Universität Wien, Erfinder 1924 bis 2002. So he is an honorary citizen of the Technical University of Vienna. It's interesting, a citizen of a university, but anyways. Born in 1924, died in 2002. And here, next to his gravestone, we can see his invention. That looks very interesting. So it demonstrates the pencil. And the technology behind how that pencil works. That's interesting.
It's great, isn't it? It's cast in bronze, and the ballpoint at the top is silver. And you can see the sort of, if you get up close, you can kind of see the brush marks of polishing.
The bronze. So every astronaut on ISS, if they want to write something in their diary, because diaries are usually handwritten, they would use Mr. Schechter's pen.
Well, I hate to say this, but there's a lot of pencils on the ISS.
Because the Russians...
And there's also a lot of Sharpies. In Australia, we'd call it a texter, but you know, felt-tipped. They do a lot of writing, but they do also have these up on the
so unromantic
station. I know. I'm sorry.
Okay. So what about that story that the Russians didn't bother inventing the space pen because they just took a pencil?
Well, people love that story because it's like so much money was poured into developing this space pen, and the Russians just like, oh, whatever. We'll take a pencil. A pencil works. And that turns out not to be quite true because, the US astronauts also used pencils. The Russians used like a glass writing pencil, particularly because graphite in space is not something. It conducts electricity. It's flammable. So you don't want loose bits of graphite floating around. Mm. So glass pencils are sort of quite greasy in texture. Mm. They're not that easy to write with, to be honest.
Okay.
Yuri lost his pencil when he went up in 1962.
Where'd he lose it?
I don't know. It just floated off.
Wow. So it's out there right now.
Not outside.
No.
Inside. Somewhere. Maybe they've found it later in there. And Valentina Tereshkova managed to break her pencil in 1963 when she went into orbit.
Valentina Tereshkova was the first woman in space.
Yeah.
Russian origin.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So space pens and pencils.
Good. Great story. Anyways, if it's not true, I still like it. Shall we make a quick break?
Let's get some more water. Mm-hmm. Oh, my leg's gone to sleep. I could offer you a glass of wine, but you probably have to drive. It's 5:00.
I'm happily accepting your invitation.
I can't promise it's of a high quality.
No.
I don't know how to judge wines with German labels. So for the record, we're now having some Grüner Veltliner, which is the Austrian wine I have determined most closely matches a Pinot Gris or a Sauvignon Blanc that I would perhaps normally drink in Australia.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful idea.
Cheers. Oh, are you recording?
Yes.
So in Australia, we would say up your bum, probably in a more informal setting.
Absolutely. That's a good one.
It's not too bad, is it?
So, Alice, would you, if the call came, would you be ready to go to the moon, to Mars, to Venus?
Okay, first of all, we're going to set aside the fact that I'm sure I would be horribly space sick, but let's just assume when the call comes, it will go away. I'd love to go to the moon. I would love to watch the interplay of light and shadow with my own eyes. Of course, I wouldn't want to go too close to any of the previous human landing sites there or even any of the previous sites. I have a huge question though. So when Luna 2 crashed onto the moon in 1959, it had two spheres of little metal medallions with Soviet symbols on them that were supposed to explode and scatter everywhere. Mm. I would love to know if that happened. I would love to know if the space around that site was covered in these little shiny hexagons.
What was the idea behind that?
Well, I guess just to leave something on the surface of the moon that was Soviet. It's like graffiti, in a way. So I'd love to see that. I'd love to watch. So a lunar day, the sunlight period is two weeks Earth time, and so is the night. So I'd love to watch the day pass and just see how the angle of the light changed the landscape. And I think Mars is boring, and I think everyone will die, but I'd love to go to Venus as well.
Yeah, I told you about that crazy project by Guillermo Sundlein and Humans to Venus. That's really, really crazy.
I love it.
So to all our listeners who have not heard the episode, it's about a project that wants to bring 1,000 humans to the Venusian atmosphere by 2050. So why the Venusian atmosphere? Because at a certain layer in that atmosphere, there is just the right pressure and just the right temperature for humans to thrive. And supposedly, allegedly, it's the most Earth-like place in the solar system, that layer of Venusian atmosphere. So
it's an Earth analog.
It's an Earth analog. It is.
I think it would be wonderful to be floating in a cloud city, skating through the clouds, looking at the layers above you, the layers below, being so much closer to the sun, thinking of what's down there on the surface.
And it pretty much aligns with the medieval circles from hell idea, because on Venus you have like that very hellish surface, completely inhospitable, even for spaceships, for spacecraft. So being in that cloud layer above it has a very a nice connection to our literature. So anyways, let's see, 2050 is not really around the corner, but we'll see if this is just another Silicon Valley dream.
Would you go and live in the clouds of Venus?
I don't know. I would not go to Mars. I would not go to Mars. And I tell you why. Because Mars is lacking that magnetic shield. So it doesn't have a magnetic shield. So you're constantly bombarded by cosmic radiation. It doesn't have an atmosphere. And you would be confined to your trailer home for the rest of your life. So would I really want that? I don't know. So it sounds fancy.
But maybe after 3 weeks, maybe not really. So I don't know. How about you? You already said you wouldn't want to go to Mars.
Yeah,
but why that?
I don't know. Mars just doesn't do it for me. I can't even articulate it. I just think Mars is overrated, really. I don't know. Whereas Venus is beautiful and mysterious.
Yeah.
And
it's our sister planet.
It is our sister planet.
Yeah.
Similar in size, similar in length of day, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it could have been us, or Earth could have been Venus. So I don't know, I feel drawn to Venus.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because it's so easy to see in the night sky as well.
Yeah. So let's go to Venus. So for that,
you and me, Marcus, we're going to Venus.
Totally. Let's just finish that recording and then head off. For that very long trip. It takes quite a while to get there, and usually those trips are boring. Just to give you a background, we set up a playlist for the aspiring space traveler on Spotify, and I asked each guest of the show, what is their one tune they wouldn't want to miss on that interplanetary voyage? So which tune would you want to introduce to that playlist? And that playlist is out there. So which tune will you choose now for your personal interplanetary voyage?
I'm going to choose a song actually by a Viennese artist, Anja Plascht, also known as Soap and Skin.
Ah.
And the song is Voyage, Voyage,
nice.
Which is actually about traveling.
Nice.
And it's a beautiful song. So you can, I learned of its existence by listening to Radio 4 off here in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my choice for you.
Nice. Good. So be it. So it's going to be uploaded or connected after the show.
Fantastic.
And one last question, as this, we're drinking wine, but this is a space cafe podcast. It's a coffee place. And usually, or now and then, in coffee places, you have an espresso to energize yourself. Now, why don't you share an espresso for the mind with us, with me, with the audience? What is it that you feel like that could be an inspiration, an energizer for the mind, for the audience? You can pick whatever kind of topic you want to pick.
An energizer for the mind. Well, I would like members of our audience today to start paying attention to their dreams and think of how often in their dreams they're flying or maybe even traveling in space, if anyone ever dreams of being in space. But to think about flying dreams and what they represent about our unconscious desires to be free of gravity and to be able to swim like fish, fly like birds, go wherever we want. That's my thought for the listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alice Gorman. That was a wonderful time.
Thank you for having me.
As always, thank you, dear listeners, for embarking on another serendipitous journey with us today. It's these unplanned, unprepared moments that truly bring out the authenticity and richness of our conversations. We are ever so grateful to our guests for their willingness to expose themselves, to share their unfiltered thoughts, experiences, and dreams with us all. A heartfelt thank you to Alice Gorman for her enlightening insights. If you have enjoyed our voyage today, please subscribe to our channel and join us as we continue to explore the uncharted territories of knowledge and experience. Share your reflections, your own serendipitous moments, and your thoughts, maybe on today's episode, in the comments in the rating section of your favorite podcast platform, or on our own dedicated platforms over at spacewatch.global. Until we meet again, keep your minds curious, your hearts open, and your spirits untamed. This is Marcus, signing off from Space Cafe Podcast. Continue to embrace the unexpected, my friends, and may your journeys be filled with serendipity. Bye-bye.
Au-dessus des vieux volcans, glisse tes ailes sur le tapis du vent. Voyage, voyage, éternel. Espagnol plus d'équateur. Voyage, voyage, vole dans les hauteurs. Au-dessus des capitales, décide fatal. Regarde l'océan. Voyage, voyage, plus loin que la nuit et les jours. Voyage dans l'espace inouï de l'amour. Voyage sur l'eau sacrée. L'Amazon, chez les blacks, chez les sikhs, chez les jaunes. Voyage, voyage dans tous les royaumes. Sur les dunes du Sahara, Fiji ou Fushihama. Voyage, voyage, ne t'arrêtez pas. Au-dessus des barbelés, des cœurs bombardés. Regarde l'océan. Voyage, voyage, plus loin que la nuit et les jours. Voyage dans l'espace inouï de l'amour. sur l'eau.